Ray Suarez's name and voice are familiar to public radio listeners. He served as the host of Talk of the Nation and the monthly program America Abroad. He was also the host of the NewsHour on PBS for 14 years. Ray Suarez is now the host of Al Jazeera America's Inside Story. This weekend, he will deliver the commencement address at Kalamazoo College and receive an honorary degree. Ray Suarez, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be here.
Why don't we talk a little bit about your decision to go from the NewsHour to Al Jazeera America? What went into that?
Well, after 14 years at the NewsHour, I had to really think about what the future would hold for me there and strip away all the sentiment, strip away my very real affection for my colleagues there and the people I had helped build the show with over the years. And I just didn't see much out there. If I stayed for 3 years or 5 years or even longer, I didn't see much improvement in my position. The finances of the NewsHour were perilous, are perilous. And as I tried to think about the latter part of my career, I just couldn't see myself there. And when you feel that way about a place, it's hard to square spending much more time there. So I started to look around.
And what brought you to Al Jazeera America? Why did you decide that was the place you wanted to be?
Well, Al Jazeera America is a startup, but it's a startup that's embedded in an established media institution. So it's got the best of both worlds, all the juice and spontaneity and inventiveness and willingness to try new things of a startup, and all the good things about an established place. Your business cards arrive with in a box, the phone on your desk rings, the checks cash, and all of those things that are great about a place that's already got its systems in order and its procedures in place. So we are Al Jazeera America, a 24-hour news network seen just in the United States and meant to be a domestic competitor to MSNBC, Fox, and CNN.
What sort of things do you think viewers would see on Al Jazeera America, assuming they haven't had the opportunity to try it, that they would not see on CNN, MSNBC, or the Fox News Channel?
Well, if you like real news, you'll like Al Jazeera America. It's a serious place to do original reporting, in-depth and unbiased. And it really has no political agenda, has no lens through which it regards the world. It's just a straight-ahead news organization. You're likely to see a lot more international coverage than I think the American services are doing, but also at the same time, a very careful attention to what's going on domestically. Al Jazeera America has opened bureaus all over the United States, so there are Al Jazeera America crews and correspondents everywhere, in the South, in the West, in the Midwest. We're the only one of the 24-hour news channels with a fully-fledged bureau in Detroit, another one in New Orleans, covering the evolving situation in those two cities and in the more predictable and usually well-staffed places like Los Angeles and Chicago and New York as well. So we're trying to cover the stories that everybody covers, but in a slightly different way, and also cover different stories from the ones that the big guys are covering right now.
I was talking with a family member recently who told me that Al Jazeera America had come on his cable system, and he turned it on and left it on and was waiting to pounce when he heard the objectionable content that he was expecting and actually found out that he enjoyed it quite a bit and thought it was very well done. Do you get that reaction a lot? Do people have a reaction to the name Al Jazeera that perhaps is different from the reaction they have to what you actually report?
You bet. And it makes it a little more challenging to win people over because they come with preconceptions. They come to the act of watching television already with an assumption about a political agenda, a worldview that they're going to see expressed in the way we tell the stories and the stories that we tell. And they are pleasantly surprised for the most part. I mean, we do have market research that shows that if we show our content to prospective viewers without the Al Jazeera labeling on it. They almost unanimously enjoy what they see and retain what they see and really like the story selection, and then are surprised to find out that it's Al Jazeera America coverage. I think that's a strength going forward, that the product speaks for itself, that the product will sell itself once we can get people to give us a chance.
And is that the key to Al Jazeera America becoming that full-fledged competitor to the other cable news networks that you mentioned?
Absolutely. You know, CNN has had at several different junctures in its roughly 35-year existence big stories that drove everybody to the television, and those were considered the moments when CNN sort of cemented itself into the American news diet. When a couple of big stories happen in the world and people try us out, at those moments where people are saying, yeah, we got to turn on the news now, I think those will be the moments where our value will be demonstrated, where the perhaps negative expectations of prospective audience members won't be met, and they'll say, they'll walk away from the TV saying, no, I really got the news. I got the story well told, skillfully told, competently reported, in a challenging, straightforward manner. And if that's what I went to see, I got what I was looking for, so I'll come back to this place. We found that when we did our first ever State of the Union address, the numbers for a normal weeknight went up by 400%, because it was one of those moments where millions of people who normally watch the State of the Union address use that as an opportunity to check out Al Jazeera America.
Now, we're speaking on Tuesday. I believe it was last night that you covered the issue of student debt, and that seems quite timely because you're about to come and give a commencement address at a private school where many of the students have had to take out large loans in order to attend. Having just kind of dove into this issue somewhat, what would you want to say to these students and other students that have to now turn around and pay these bills after they graduate?
That I know what they're up against, that I really want them to think about their educations not just in financial terms. Yes, they've just swallowed a big gulp, and for many of them, that's going to mean years where they're paying off that educational bill. But if they look at it just in terms of dollars and cents, they'll be making a mistake, because part of the reason to get an education, this isn't just a fancy trade school. Kalamazoo College is not a trade school. You didn't just go to get training for the workforce. You went also to become a person who, through the value of your education, knows where he or she fits in the world, understands the world that's coming down the pike, so life won't be a series of nasty surprises, but will happen with you rather than to you. You won't constantly be bewildered or unable to make sense of the times that you live in. That's part of what we get an education for, I hope, not just for an enhanced paycheck. And that's part of what I'll be telling them on Sunday.
Your most recent book is Latinos, the 500-year history that shaped the nation. What was the most surprising thing that you came across as you were doing research, or maybe the thing that surprises readers the most when they pick this up?
The thing that I wanted to remind people in the most affirming way possible, not the way of, come on, everybody, you know, get with it. This has been a multicultural country since day one. This has been a country with a strong Latino presence since Columbus. But rather to invite people to rethink their idea, the idea that generations of schooling in the United States has given us, that America is an enterprise that begins at Plymouth Rock and at Jamestown and just moves west, this English-derived thing that ends up covering this whole continental-sized country. But that when the pilgrims hadn't even arrived in Massachusetts yet. St. Augustine, Florida was already a well-established Spanish-speaking city. When Jamestown was a struggling stockade on the muddy coasts of Virginia, Santa Fe was already the seat of a Spanish governor overseeing a colony. That when people are sitting in traffic on the I-5 between San Diego and Los Angeles, that San Diego and Los Angeles are named those two things because those were Spanish cities, part of the Spanish Empire, meant to extend both military and religious control up the Pacific coast of North America. These are things that should widen your arms and be encouraging you to wrap your arms around a more inclusive, more complicated view of the history of this continent, rather than a sort of cramped, English-only, exclusivist kind of idea. And through the whole 270 or so pages of the book, I try to gently remind the reader of how the Latino presence in North America is not some Johnny-come-lately thing with the people who just arrived the day before yesterday, but has been a long, formative, influential piece of American history always.
How does that history, or perhaps the misreading of that history, influence the way that we now view issues like, say, immigration?
Well, and if you have a healthy appetite for irony, you might roll your eyes a little bit the next time some Florida school district enters a protracted battle over the role of Spanish in the public schools. When Spanish has been spoken in Florida for centuries longer than English, you have to have that broader view of American history in order to understand the U.S. role in the world. Once we became the modern state that we are, roughly at the end of the 19th century, took over Puerto Rico, occupied Cuba, took the Philippines, that we became a place that not only sent soldiers and sailors out to the world, but took in people from the rest of the world, and that role has meant we were going to be a different kind of place. We weren't going to be an ethnically uniform, socially uniform, racially uniform. We were never going to be that kind of place. And so we've always had this very ambiguous relationship with ambivalent relationship with multiculturalism. Instead of just recognizing it as part of our DNA, we've given maybe on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays we embrace it, and on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays we sort of push it away. It's a funny part of American history.
You've also wrote books that deal with sort of the overlap of religion and politics, as well as the issue of urban flight. What kind of makes a topic important enough to you where you say, I got to go beyond reporting it on television or radio. This needs a book to tackle it. What sort of takes you in that direction?
Well, there are some stories that are fascinating to me that there's just no way to stuff that much storytelling into even long form television. And I've done some documentaries. It's tough to get it all in there. So something like What Happened to the Old American Cities After the Second World War is a big, sprawling, complicated story with no right answers and a lot of memories, different memories of the experience that live in different people's heads. And that's what really turns me on about a story like that. The intertwining of politics and religion in the United States in the late 20th century had so many moving parts and so many influential characters and has touched on so many different parts of our common life that That really appealed to me as a story, but it's very tough to tell either on radio or on television. So a book gives you an opportunity to really stretch out and tell a big, complicated story that rolls out over the course of decades. It works totally different muscles for a reporter. It forces you to think in totally different ways about how to tell a story and how to structure a story. I mean, it's the difference between, eating a whole smorgasbord or just having a couple of snack peanuts from a bowl. It's just entirely different from taking one event that happened in one day in one city and on television that night say, here's what happened in 2.5 or 3 or 4 minutes.
Is there another book you're working on now, or is there something that's rattling around in your head that you're thinking needs to be tackled in book form?
Well, there are some things that I want to get started probably next year. When I first signed up with Al Jazeera America, it was part of company policy that correspondents should not be writing books. And I understand that. I understand why the policy existed. But I also think that my bosses now recognize the value in it because they saw me quoted and speaking and traveling when I was touring the Latino history book and saw a lot of value in that for having their name and one of the faces most associated with their network out in the country talking to audiences across the country. So I want to write a book about American politics. The toughest book, the one that I've wanted to write for the longest time, but would probably involve taking off work. These other books I wrote almost entirely while I was working full time. But I want to write a book about modern South Africa, and I really can't do that without going there for a long time. So I have one kid in high school. When she leaves home, I think I can actually start to think seriously about writing the book about the democratization of South Africa and what happened instead of a civil war and why a civil war didn't happen there, which to me is one of the great undertold stories of the second half of the last century.
So if one of those students who is graduating from Kalamazoo College is listening to you talk on Sunday, and they're thinking about going into a career in journalism, are there some things that you would advise them? Are there some things that you think they should be aware of before they take that step in this day and age?
Only half jokingly, I always begin my answer to that question the same way, which is my best piece of advice is have a really good plan B. Today, in 2014, there are fewer people making a living as journalists in the United States than in the year 2000. And when you think about how much more content and how many more ways to transmit content there are now than there used to be, the fact that there are fewer people able to make a living in journalism is a sobering thing to anybody who wants to devote their life to this work. And it's a wonderful life. It's good work. It's important work. A democracy needs information like a body needs oxygen. So on that score, nothing changes. You know, it's always been important work, and it always will be important work. But whether it's work that can sustain you, help you live out your material dreams, help you be employed in a sustained fashion over the long haul, whether journalism is going to be the thing that you'll be able to do always, those are open questions for a lot of people. So yes, I would encourage any young person who really wants to do it that they should do it. One thing I note is that if people are really cut out for it, nothing I'm going to say is going to discourage them anyway. So it's only the people who may be on the fence who would hear me say discouraging things and say, uh-oh, maybe I should do something else. I love this work. I always have. I love it even when I hate it. and the hours are tough. And if you're someone who values regularity and routine, predictability, stability in your domestic life, this may not be for you. If you're someone who wants your days off, regular and predictable, and have your clock set the same time all the time, this may not be for you. But if you really want to be a witness to and an interpreter of the events that shape the world you live in and help other people understand it so they can do the work of being a citizen, then if that idea turns you on, then you're probably cut out for this work. I would never try to discourage people who really think they have a desire for it, but it's going to be a very different business moving ahead, but in ways that I can't predict yet, because right now we're tearing apart and rebuilding a transcontinental jet at 35,000 feet somewhere over the Midwest. It's hair-raising. The whole business model of how we sustain a news business and how we pay the people who work in it is under assault and being radically rethought as we're doing it. So I can't predict where things land when someone who gets in the business today is in mid-career, roughly in the late 2030s, let's say. Who knows? Number of years ago from today, we couldn't have predicted what the internet is doing to the news business right now. So it's impossible for me to sit here and say, here's what young aspiring journalists have waiting for them out there. So, yes, I think there still will be journalists. I think there's plenty of work to do and plenty of good work to be done. But the business model is unclear. The technological model is unclear. The creation of audiences and the sustaining of revenue streams is unclear. It's really going to be a wild time to be getting into this business.
Ray Smaras, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me. Can't wait to come to Kalamazoo.
Ray Smaras is a former public radio and public television host. He's now the host of Al Jazeera America's Inside Story. He will deliver the commencement address Sunday at Kalamazoo College.